We'll begin our service this evening with the use of number 310 in the songbook. While you're finding your places, I'm going to read the announcements. As much as possible, would you kneel with me in the opening prayer? Our kind and gracious Heavenly Father, as we do approach Thy throne again this day, again, Father, I am thankful for the beauty of this day and the peacefulness of this place. I'm thankful, Father, for the freedom which we enjoy in this land. I'm thankful for the gift of Your Son in this gospel. As we come to You this evening, I pray, Father, that You would bless us as a group here this evening. Bless our brother Bob as he would stand before us to speak those things which You have placed upon his heart. Father, that he might be able to have that freedom and that strength to deliver that message which You have given him. I pray for each of us, Father, that we may have our hearts open, and that Spirit which only cometh from Thee might be able to carry that message into our hearts this night. I ask for the many needs of Your church, for the names that were mentioned this day, for those that were ministered to. We pray, Father, that Thy Spirit would work upon them and strengthen them. Those that aren't present here this evening, that Thy blessing would be with them as well, whether they be at work or they be sick or just decided not to come. I pray, Father, that Your gentle Spirit would rest upon them. In all things, we desire to bring You honor and glory. Again, we invite and ask Thy Spirit to attend us here this night, for we ask it in Christ's holy name. Amen. Our second song is going to be a special. That song. You know, Bob's my next door neighbor, but I don't get to see him very much. Seems like our paths don't cross very often. Once in a while, he sticks his head over the fence to see what noise I'm making out there at 10 o'clock at night. But I am thankful to have him as a neighbor, and I'm thankful to have him as a pastor, and I'm thankful to be able to hear him here this evening. And I'd ask that you'd give him your kind and careful attention this evening.
Your prayers. Also enjoy having me for a neighbor, I have to admit. I do feel like I stand in a great deal of need of prayers this evening. Some of the things I want to bring out are not simple order. They're just different. I'm going to do things differently tonight, a little bit. I don't want this to be, I guess, my sermon is, I don't want this to be a sermon, if that makes sense. I'd rather have this go more as a class. Because some of the things I'm going to talk about are can be confusing. This is going to be part history lesson, part science lesson. It's class. There's going to be a test partway through it. But instead of sitting there saying, what do you say? I would really appreciate if you say, hey, I'm not following that. Can you clear something up for me? Because if I stand up here and talk for an hour, maybe two or three, you guys aren't, and you don't grasp what I'm trying to get across, then we're wasting our time. And that's my hope, is to just edify you in some way, to prepare you for things that will come. So, don't hesitate to, don't feel like you're interrupting anything, because you're not. But there are some things I'd like to talk about. We'll start with the history lesson. History of the modern restored church. Joseph Smith received the plates, the gold plates of the Book of Mormon on September 22nd of 1827. He had been going there every year for the last several years. And the angel had been telling him that, you know, keep coming back here on this date every year, and when the time is right, when the fullness of times has come for them to be restored, they will. And also, I think it was Yom Kippur that year, just from Glenn's Exodus thing about the importance of those festival dates. So he got them on September 22nd, 1827, he started the translating with the Urim and Thummim on April the 15th of 1828. Martin Harris was his scribe at the time. And they were going along, until, you know, they also had to do the work in their crops and their fields and that kind of stuff. Until June of 1828. June of 1828, Martin Harris's wife says, you know, you're wasting way too much time over there at Joseph Smith House. You know, I need you home. You need to be providing for your family. And he's going, yeah, but we're doing a great work. You know, we're translating these things. And she says, yeah, right. And so he talks to Joseph, and Joseph says, you know, Joseph had been commanded by the angel, says, don't let any of it get out. Don't have any of it published until it's all published. So naturally Joseph Smith did the exact opposite. They had 116 pages of manuscript that had been translated that Joseph Smith allowed Martin Harris to take home to his wife to say, see, we are working. I'm not hanging out over there playing Nintendo. We are doing something here. Well, his wife wasn't impressed because she was against the whole thing to begin with. And in the process, those first 116 pages were lost. They came into the hands of the people who were enemies, I guess, as for lack of a better word, of the restoring of the gospel. And the Lord wasn't real thrilled about it either. So he came and took back the plates. No translation was done for quite some time. Until Oliver Cowdery came along, and Oliver Cowdery come along on April 5th of 1829, almost a year again back to when Martin Harris started. So naturally, they didn't have anything started with, so they couldn't retranslate what had already been done. It was lost. So they picked up where they left off and began translating with Oliver Cowdery being the scribe. They worked on that from April 5th, 1829, until August of 1829. It was done, completely translated, and they had this piece of paper, and all handwritten, of the Book of Mormon. It had chapter breaks in it, didn't have any verses, didn't have any punctuation, didn't have any capitalization. It was strictly, word for word. So they're getting ready to publish this, and they say, we need a second copy in case something happens to the first one. This right here is the original manuscript, what they had finished. Original manuscript. Then they took the original manuscript, and right next to it, they started writing, copying it over again. Once again, it was Oliver Cowdery again. And they did the whole thing on a separate piece of paper. And this is what's called the printer's manuscript. But the problem is that anything that man does, errors come in. And try as they might, the printer's manuscript isn't quite the same as the original manuscript. Every once in a while, a word gets dropped, a word gets added that was unintentional. They don't change the meaning, but they're there. So then we have the printer's manuscript. And the printer's manuscript was given to the printer in August of 1829. In March of 1830, the Book of Mormon is actually published by something Grandin was his last name, there in Palmyra. Well, and as usual, the errors of men are in that, because one would think, well, if you had the printer's manuscript and you had gave that to the printer would give you back exactly what he gave you. No, because every once in a while, a word got transposed, a word got dropped, a word got changed. And so the 1830 edition of the Book of Mormon isn't quite the same as the printer's manuscript. And this all makes sense at the end, I hope. By the way, that's what we're trying to do on the board right now, is trying to figure out what was this. Because what happened with this was we took this document, we don't want anything to happen to it, so we put it in the cornerstone of the Kirtland Temple, and it got wet and rotted. And when they opened it up, it was just a bunch of mush. And so they broke off what they could, and it was a great, honor, I guess. And they just started, you can have these few pages of the Book of Mormon, and you can have this page, and it was scattered all over. And through time, people have brought back what they have, and what the only maybe 20% of the actual original manuscript is existent. The rest of it has gone the way of all the earth. But, all the way back here, before even September, things happened that the people in the neighborhood, when they found out the experiences that Joseph Smith had, from that moment on, began to try and destroy it. I believe that Satan was working on their hearts, because he knew what the result of this was. And so through this whole process, that's why we lost this 116 pages, Satan, the adversary, has tried to say that it doesn't exist. It's not a true record. That it was made up by Joseph Smith. And we did a study years ago. I don't know if you remember this. We did a study about different things that the critics of the Book of Mormon said about it. Do you remember it? Yes, no, maybe. We had a whole list of questions about different things that people said. Do you remember what some of them were? Any idea? How about, what they would do is typically they attack Joseph Smith. Because they figure if they attack Joseph Smith, then that makes this irrelevant because it came from him, right? But besides attacking Joseph Smith, you guys remember the Solomon Spaulding document. Solomon Spaulding was a writer that lived about the same time, and he had a story called Manuscript Found, or Manuscript Story, or something like that, that was about a bunch of Hebrews that came to America. And they said, well, Joseph Smith just copied off that. And when you compare the two, the Solomon Spaulding manuscript was never published. It can never be proved that Joseph Smith ever saw it. And the differences are so dramatic that they can't be, there's nothing at all the same. You know, the Indians described in the Spaulding book are the Indians of the popular imagination. They lived in teepees and hunted turkeys and deer and you know, did all kinds of typical New England Indian stuff that you don't find in the Book of Mormon. And a bunch of other things that I don't want to get too far into. I just want to briefly overview some of this stuff. But that was one of the things that was thrown at him. And you know, you remember every few years something new comes out. You know, a few years ago it was the Godmakers. You remember that book? Everybody in the world was talking about, oh, the Godmakers is going to bring down the Mormon Church. It's such a shocking expose of all the terrible things that are wrong. And well, when we read the book, because it's talking about a lot of Mormon doctrine that you can't find anywhere. Matter of fact, I found it so interesting that the people that wrote the Godmakers to try and destroy the Mormon Church say, you know what? There's nothing in the Book of Mormon about Mormonism. You know, all this other stuff that they're attacking, we'll say, well, it's not even in the Book of Mormon. And we're saying, yeah. That's the whole point. Some of the other things that they talk about, well, there's no archaeological evidence that, you know, remember, this is 1830. There's no archaeological evidence that these Indians, you know, that live in teepees and eat and wear wild animal skins and do all this crazy stuff, had these huge cities and huge populations and built towns and had nations until in the mid-1800s when, was it Catherwood? What was that? Stevens and Catherwood. A couple explorers that wandered off into the jungles in Central America and found these huge cities. Joseph Smith knew nothing about them. And it caused all the scientists of the day to say, wait a minute, maybe we don't know everything. But people still say, well, you know, that's different. You know, all that archaeological stuff doesn't really prove the Book of Mormon. And it doesn't. Nothing will ever prove the Book of Mormon. It's a document of faith. It's not a scientific document. What are some of the other things? The Book of Mormon talks about barley. And so that was their big thing. You know what? It can't be true because there's no barley in America. And you remember what happened here in Phoenix in the 1980s? They're working on the freeway. Guess what? They found a pot with barley in it. Oops. Well, I can wad that one up and throw it away. Steel, iron. In the Book of Mormon, right? And they're saying, well, at least the Indians, they used stones for their arrowheads, and they didn't have any metal at all. I mean, that's what they traded for every time they had a chance was to get the metal knives, because they didn't have metal. But I find it interesting that when the Spaniards came in 1519, Bernal Diaz, one of the soldiers that was there, says made the interesting observation that they already had a word in their vocabulary for iron. Now, why would they have something, a word for something, but they'd never seen it before? I don't know. And there's other things that as history goes through, that things come up, and we say, oh, well, maybe so. You guys remember any more of these criticisms? About chariots. You know, there's no such thing as chariots, because the Indians didn't have horses, and they say all this stuff. When they find horses in the La Brea tar pits in California. Oops. And they find the little wheeled toys down there in Central America. Well, you know, having a wheeled toy doesn't really mean that they had chariots or anything, because naturally just the kids would know how to use the wheel, the adults wouldn't. And there's a whole list of things. One of the ones I remember was that the Jesus of the Book of Mormon is not the same Jesus as the Bible. Because Jesus in the Bible, he came and preached love and forgiveness, and everything was going to be okay. And you know, almost when they talked, you could hear the birdies chirping and feel the breeze and the stream going by. That's the Jesus of the Bible. But the Jesus of the Book of Mormon, when he was crucified, whole cities were destroyed and millions maybe perished. Well, you know, that's not my Jesus. But then when you go into the history and find out, you know, what happened to Jerusalem after they crucified Christ? Josephus was a general who saw it. He tells us the surrounding country was gathered to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover when the Roman army began to lay siege to the city. He describes in great detail the war and resulting destruction of the city and 1.1 million men, women, and children that were destroyed in the city of Jerusalem when the Romans came. Another 97,000 were carried away as captives and sold into the slavery, taken into the Colosseum and destroyed by beasts of the you know, lions and tigers. Remember the lions and Christians game? The lions always won. He did the same thing to the Jews after they destroyed Jerusalem. Wait a minute, this was the God of love and peace and mercy. And the historian Eusebius says, you know what? This was payment for what they had done. This was a result of their decisions. Well, the reason, when going through all of this, and I hope it makes sense eventually, and all of this is Jay's fault, just so you know. Jay asked me a question a couple weeks ago, and I didn't know the answer. So I started looking. And my purpose of this is, guess what? The critics have a new idea. They finally figured out how to destroy the Book of Mormon, to prove beyond any reasonable doubt that it's wrong. So, now comes the test. I'll step over here because I don't want to say this across the pulpit. The Book of Mormon is a piece of 19th century fiction. And this means that we have to acknowledge that sometimes Joseph Smith lied. What do you think of that? A Book of Mormon is just a bunch of fiction. Are you going to sit there and take that? I'm not. Well, you got to get. What's the first one? What do you mean by that? Oh, thank you, Chase. Does my heart good to say. That's a fair question. What do I mean by the Book of Mormon is a piece of 19th century fiction? Well, I happen to be a geneticist, a molecular geneticist. And I can safely say that now that quantitative scientific methods can indeed test for an Israelite genetic presence in ancient America, we learn that virtually all Native Americans can trace their lineages to the Asian migrations between 7,000 and 50,000 years ago, while molecular anthropologists have the technological capability to identify descendants of ancient Hebrews, no such traces of DNA markers have appeared in Central America or elsewhere among Native Americans. From a scientific perspective, the Book of Mormon's origin is best situated in early 19th century America, and Lamanite genesis can only be traced historically to 1828. The term Lamanite is a modern social and political designation that lacks a verifiable biological or historical underpinning linking it to ancient American Indians. The Book of Mormon emerged from an antebellum, meaning pre-Civil War perspective, out of a frontier American people struggle with their God, and not from an authentic American Indian perspective. What do you think of that? That's what I mean by that.
How do you know that's true?
Because I am a scientist. I have more letters at the end of my name than you do. I've been to school and I've learned such things. Well, good. I'm not a scientist, but I play one on TV. So what we're talking about is deoxyribonucleic acid, DNA. I'm going to try and quickly explain DNA in such a way that you can understand it. So this may be a challenge, and that's why I want you to say, hey, I'm not quite following this. I want you to wave your hand. DNA is what is found in all of our cells. It's in the nucleus. It's our fingerprint, basically. You know, you guys may have heard about the Human Genome Project that's been going on, and the filing cabinets would fill this room of you know, the billions of different items on our DNA. And what DNA is, it's a helix. And helix is going to look something like this. And it's going to have these bars in it like this. Okay? Now, it's like a ladder that's got twisted, got too hot or something. So I'm going to untwist this ladder, and it's going to look like this. It's going to have all these bars going across. Okay, does that make sense? Are we following so far? Okay, and each of these cross things are molecular bonds, and there's four different proteins that make up our DNA. There's adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. There's not going to be a test on this part, okay? Just get the concept is all I'm looking for. And adenine always hooks up with guanine, and guanine always hooks up with adenine, and so forth and so on, okay? And these letters keep going on and on and on and on and on for billions of different things, okay? So far, we're on the same page. Okay. What happens is when your cell feels the urge to make two, to cell division. There you go. There's biology from 101 from a long time ago. It splits for whatever reason. We don't really know why. Right there. And when it splits, we got half a ladder. And there's half this ladder hanging out there in the soup. And so all the adenines that are loose hook up to the guanines. And all the, you know, so forth and so on, so that these different proteins all bond to the certain things. And all of a sudden, now we got two ladders that are a carbon copy of the first one. Comprendo? All right. Except every once in a while, it changes. It mutates. And thankfully, I forget what they said. When Jay asked me this question, I didn't know how bad it was going to be, but scientists are not good writers, And I've been reading a whole lot, and it makes my brain hurt. And so hopefully I can explain it in such a way that your brain doesn't hurt. But these mutations occur at 2.5, okay, I got back up. These little things here, this is called a nucleotide. Once again, it's not going to be on a test, just get the concepts. All these little proteins are called nucleotides. A group of nucleotides closely bunched together that form an allele. And you're saying, well, what's an allele? An allele is a genetic marker that says blue eyes, or brown eyes, or green eyes, or something like that. Some characteristic of the DNA is called an allele. And so when you get several alleles together, it's called, and this will all make sense, I hope, eventually, a haplogroup. I don't know why they think these things up, but that's what they call them, a haplogroup. And a haplogroup is all these different alleles that say, okay, if you have blonde hair and blue eyes and all these different things, that this is kind of the Swedish marker. When they bring these different combinations that are common to a certain race, they can make a marker for that race. They call it a haplogroup. So what's been done is they did some research on, it's called mitochondrial DNA. Mitochondrial DNA is kind of interesting because it's only passed on from mother to daughter. Okay? Men don't pass it on. It's only and it's not from mother to, it's to mother, only to mother to daughter. It's only carried by the females. So they did all this research on mitochondrial DNA, and they said there are four groups from Native Americans, different haplogroups, and being scientists with great imaginations, they called them A, B, C, and D. And they said, you know what? Every one of those haplogroups comes from Asia. And so we can prove that since all of these things come from Asia, well, that means that all of the Native Americans came across the Bering Sea land bridge and populated America. Does that make sense so far? Okay, this is the basis for this argument. And I wanted to specify, the people that are making this argument are not the ones that do the research. The people that make the arguments about these theology-type questions look at research that other people have done and retranslate it into fit what they want it to say. Okay? So the people that are making this comment never did the research on the actual DNA. All this research is in libraries, and they just went to the libraries and looked it up and picked out what they wanted to make it fit. So, that's great, except for all of a sudden, that was about 1995 when all that happened. And 1998, all of a sudden something happened. Well, you know, A, B, C, and D are the majority of them. Well, there's one more. There's haplogroup X. You know, like I said, scientists are not the most original thinkers. Some of them, I guess. They call it haplogroup X. I'm going to read this. This is out of the journal called Science. Anthropologists have long assumed that the first Americans who crossed into North America by way of the Bering Strait were originally of Asian stock. But recently they have been puzzled by surprising features on a handful of ancient American skeletons, including the controversial one known as Kennewick Man. Anybody remember Kennewick Man? This guy found up in Washington State. He looks like Patrick Stewart, the guy from Star Trek. Okay? He looks like an English gentleman. They're going, what in the world is an English gentleman doing out here? And they figured, well, he's a trapper until they figured out he's 10,000 years old. 10,000 years old, wait a minute. Well, we'll get back to that. I wasn't kidding about 2 or 3 hours. Features that resemble those of Europeans rather than Asians. Now, a new genetic study may link Native Americans and people of Europe and the Middle East, offering tantalizing support for a controversial theory that a band of people who originally lived in Europe or Asia Minor were among the continent's first settlers. The new data from a genetic marker appropriately called Lineage X suggest a definite, if ancient, link between Eurasians, people that live, Eurasia is Europe and Asia, and Native Americans, says Theodore Schur, a molecular anthropologist from the team, including a bunch of guys from Rome and Germany, was searching for the source population of a puzzling marker known as X. This marker was found at low frequencies throughout modern Native Americans and has also turned up in the remains of ancient Americans. Haplogroup X was different. It was spotted by Toroni in a small number of European populations. They analyzed blood samples from Native American, European, and Asian populations and reviewed published studies. We fully expected to find it in Asia, like the other four Native American markers, says Brown. To their surprise, however, haplogroup X was only confirmed in the genes of a smattering of living people in Europe and Asia Minor, including Italians, Finns, and certain Israelis. The team's review of published mitochondrial DNA sequences suggests that it may also be in Turks, Bulgarians, and Spaniards. But Brown's research has yet to find haplogroup X in any Asian population. It's not in Tibet, Mongolia, Southeast Asia, or Northeast Asia. The only time you pick it up is when you move west into Eurasia. All right. That makes sense, doesn't it, to us? That they can find this marker called haplogroup X. Only problem is, in 2001, things changed again. All of a sudden, this scientist finds haplogroup X in Siberia, in a group of people called the Altai. There's two groups of Altais. There's a northern group and a southern group. And there's only about 60,000 of them total, and they're in southwest Siberia. And it says the southern Altaians are typical Asian Mongoloid. They look like all the other Asian peoples. But the northern ones exhibit some Caucasoid anthropological features. Caucasoid means Caucasian. It means they look like you and me. Poor them. So what are these people doing in the middle of Siberia? So before we can say point to it and say, hey, look, this haplogroup X proves it, we can't say that. Haplogroup X in Siberia says, basically, we don't know. We don't know how they got there, why they didn't affect anybody else in Asia. Were they people just moving through? Did they come from America and go to Siberia? Across the other way. That's the thing. People talk about, you know, DNA. I always looked at DNA saying, you know, someday we'll be able to find the 10 tribes of Israel by looking at DNA. You know, because we're smart and we can figure out what they're supposed to look like, DNA. And the fact of the matter is, we can take another. I like Channel 8, PBS, and Nova, all that stuff. There's a guy they called Cheddar Man, like in cheese. And Cheddar is a town in England. And they found this, you know, once again, it's always 10,000 years, a 10,000-year-old skeleton in the peat moss there. And so, lo and behold, they dig it up, and they were able to extract DNA out of it. And they thought, oh, that's cool. They said, well, let's try and figure out where he belongs, you know, what race he is and all that kind of stuff. They were able to find a living descendant in the same town as this guy that lived 10,000 years ago because he had the same genetic markers. You know, it wasn't all the town, but they found one. hadn't evolved at all in 10,000 years. It was the same markers. Those are things that DNA can do. Coming from an ancient skeleton and coming back and saying, okay, we know that this person related. Where it gets fuzzy, you know, some of this stuff is harder than Chinese arithmetic, and we're going to talk Chinese arithmetic later. Is trying to go, okay, we have a modern population that says, that has this bunch of DNA markers, where did they come from? And that, DNA can't go backwards. It can't project where it came from. It can detect migration routes, but it can't pinpoint what made up that population entirely. I'm going to cut this down a little bit. Another thing, that when you look at there's another way of getting DNA. We talked about mitochondrial DNA coming from the mothers, and there's also a way of getting it from the Y chromosome. The Y chromosome Y chromosome is male. Women have two X chromosomes, and men have an XY chromosomes, and why, I don't know. That's just the way God made us. But they can trace Y chromosome DNA. But that's only passed from father to son, naturally. Okay? So if they can trace this Y chromosome, and they can trace a mitochondrial DNA chromosome for females, let's take an individual here. This is individual X. I'll pretend I'm a scientist and think of something. Okay, that individual has two parents. A mother, a father, we'll call him, no, a mother will call X and a father will call Y. Make sense? Okay. Well, they had parents as well. Oops. I hope they didn't do that back then. Hush. You're mocking me, aren't you? Okay. We're just barely going back here in time. This is only four generations. Okay? And what do we know about this individual? We can trace the mitochondrial markers from, if this is female, back to here, to this individual. And if this happened to be a, you know, if this is a male, we can't trace it at all. I mean, if it's female, we can't trace any of the male markers. If it happens to be a male, then we can trace this line to this guy. But so we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We've got 8 different people that are parents of this individual. And depending on the sex of this individual, we can know what 2 of them at most are. 6 of them, we have no clue about any of the genetic makeup of any of these people. Are these the ancestors of this person? Yeah. I mean, it's right there. But as marriages and kids come together, you know, those lines of DNA die out. And on both the mother's and father's side, this is only 4 generations. This is like going back 100 years. And we could only tell about 2 of your 6 grandparents, great grandparents. Well, now look at great grandparents, and we still only can tell about 1 or 2 people out of 16, 32, 64. Out of 64 people, we know about 2 of them, at most. Because as it doesn't, the DNA does not continue on. It dies off at different stages. There are limitations to DNA. It's not the all-inclusive, wonderful thing. Okay? I found the Chinese arithmetic, a guy named Chang. He made this observation that, you know, if you keep going this out, if you go back 1,000 years from right now, and you figure that every generation's 25 years, that's 4 people per 100 years, four generations for 100 years, so that's 40 generations. In 40 generations, you have 1 trillion parents. Well, guess what? There's never been a trillion people on the earth. And he did some analysis, and he figured out, you know, if you take somebody that lives in Europe and lived in Europe all their life, that everyone alive now in Europe that, you know, didn't just move there, is descended from English royalty. Because there's a breakover time where the population is the same as the parentage. You know, the same number of parents is the population at the time, and so they must start going in. And they found that you can trace it back to one person 600 years ago is the common ancestor for all the people in Europe. That's only 600 years. And we haven't heard, you know, and the Book of Mormon was, we haven't heard anything in from them in 1600. So we don't know what's happened to the DNA of the Nephites and Lamanites and Zoramites and ites and ites and ites. It is so mutated. It is so confusing, I guess, for lack of a better term. Okay. Another problem with this statement and claim is that they're looking for Jewish DNA. How many Jews came? It is in the Book of Mormon. It came to the Americas during the Book of Mormon times. Any idea that can be documented that we have a pretty good idea they're Jews? Mulek was in line for the throne, so we can assume he was Jewish. He was from the tribe of Judah. Nobody else can say for sure that they are Jewish. Remember? Lehi and all his family were from the tribe of Manasseh. They were sons of Joseph, who was sold into Egypt. You know who Manasseh's mom was? An Egyptian. Okay, so all that female mitochondrial DNA that supposedly comes from Joseph that we should see is going to be Egyptian. It's not Hebrew even to begin with. And what does Jaredite DNA look like? Jaredite was before there were Hebrews even. So we don't know what we're looking for, but we can make a statement that we know it's not here. Okay. Something else that comes out in this when you start looking deep at the actual research. We're going to talk about Y chromosomes. You guys know what it means. This is a guy in 1999. This was a study he did from 306 men. From all over the world, only 306, okay? So it's not a very good sampling to begin with, and only 10 of them were from North and South America. But this is his statement. The major Amerindian, American Indian, they combine it to Amerindian, because I guess it takes up less space, I don't know. It's described here as haplotype 31, haplotype 10, differing from haplotype. Haplotype 10 and 31 is what they call it when they talk about Y chromosomes. A, B, C, and D are talking about mitochondrial DNA, just so you know what we're talking about. But as it goes down, it's talking about these different haplotypes that are found in Altaians and Native Americans, Nadines. And they're different frequencies, and it says, European ancestry was confirmed for at least one of these four Native American samples with haplotype 1 in the paternity test report. Therefore, the presence of haplotype 1 in North American Indians can be explained as a result of recent admixture from Europeans. So what they say is, you know, we're looking for say even Middle Eastern DNA in markers. And but you know what? When we find it, well, you know what? It's European, so we're going to exclude it because it's obviously after Columbus came. So even if they find it, it's discarded. Another one. This is from two scientists called Stone and Stone King. This is 1998. And this was with mitochondrial DNA from the mothers. This is from pre-Columbian, before Columbus, skeletons dating about 1300 AD. They had 152 individuals. 102 could be assigned one of the four primary haplogroups, A, B, C, and D. Six did not possess any of the characteristic markers and were designated as belonging to a group designated other. And the remaining 44 did not; they couldn't get DNA out of. The individuals included 12 with, and this is a quote from them, 25 distinct lineages were found. Two of these lineages were excluded from further analysis as likely cases of contamination, despite multiple independent extractions of these samples. The sequence of lineage 25 matched the sequence of the primary author, the guy that's writing the book. His DNA matched one of the things. The lineage 2 sequence was identical to one found in two Finnish individuals. Remember from Finland? They raise a whole lot of questions about Finland, about where people came from Finland and the possible connection to Hebrews, but that's another story altogether. Although the sequence does not match the author's sequence of that of the primary osteologist, the bone scientist, involved with the sample, this lineage may be the result of contamination from an unknown source. So they use great care. They do a multiple test to find out, you know, what's wrong with this sample. And every time they get it, they get the exact same thing. Well, it must be after Columbus. No, it must be contamination. Because these things were pre-Columbian skeletons. You know, when you find something that doesn't fit, you just exclude it. Because it's got to be contamination. Because everybody knows that all the Native Americans come from Asia. And so if you find something different, it's an interesting concept. When you do research and you get data, when the data doesn't match your conclusions, the data is wrong. Instead of considering, well, maybe our conclusion is wrong. Okay? Smithsonian Institute. Guy makes an interesting observation. This is a Smithsonian archaeologist, Dennis Stanford. I just think it's going to be much more complex than we've thought in the past. He believes that Americans arrived at different times from different places and by different means, on foot, in boats, and maybe even by dog sled. Another one says, talking about these different skulls that they found, and none of the ancient skulls look like Indians. And they're coming to the realization, this is from a Discover magazine. It seems that thousands of years ago, years before the arrival of Columbus, America was already something of a melting pot. Interesting. You know, I'm way out of, I don't know. I'm going to get a couple things real quick is all I want to cover. In the Book of Mormon, somewhere, I'm just going to reference it. I'm not going to read it. In the Book of Mormon, 2 Nephi, in the first chapter, he's talking about how this land was going to be a land. I'm going to read it. Second Nephi, in the first chapter. And I'll start with the sixth verse. It's on page 78. It said, "But said he, notwithstanding our afflictions, we have obtained a land of promise, a land which is choice above all other lands, a land which the Lord God hath covenanted with me, should be a land for the inheritance of my seed. Yea, the Lord hath coveted this land unto me and to my children forever, and also that they should be led out, and also all they that should be led out of other countries by the hand of the Lord." Who is that? Well, we don't know. The Lord can make that covenant to anybody. To say that I'm going to make a covenant with ye that this is your land as well. It's not just the 400 years or the 1600 years between 400 AD when the Book of Mormon ends and roughly now. To say that, well, nothing happened until Columbus came. It can't be shown. It can't be proved. It's just a statement. This land, it's a. For years, the Book of Mormon was looked at as the basis for the history of all Native American people. That it explained the existence of all the Indians. And that's the way it was accepted. Thing is, it's never what it says. Book of Mormon never claims to explain the occurrence of all the Indians in the Americas. Okay? And something to consider, it never says that when they got here, they were the only ones here. All it says is that, we got here. Remember that first 116 pages that were lost? We don't even have them. We don't know what that said. But several places in the Book of Mormon it says, these are spiritual things. These are the spiritual experiences of my people. This is their prophecies. This is the ministering of God amongst them. If you want to find out about our history, it's in my other book. So to make a statement about, we cannot say that there were not other people here that God led out at different times. We can't say it. But it doesn't change the validity of that book. Remember, some of those statements I made talked about 7,000 to 50,000 years ago is when all these people came from Asia. And the only way they can make that claim about time, it's like with carbon dating. It's a guess. Okay? They say, we think that the genes mutate at this rate. And they count backwards that way. And that's where they come up with their range from, well, we think it's between here and here. Okay? And if you want the numbers, it's 0.025 mutations per nucleotide per 1,000 years. That's slow. But when they look at, they have the actual DNA mutations that they can find. When they look at groups of people that they can closely track the DNA and they can track it back, X number of generations, and look at mutations, they find a 2.5 mutation per nucleotide per 1,000 years. That's far greater. And when you use those numbers, it says, remember a few years ago when they had the Eve, they found Eve? They found the DNA of Eve, the marker. We found that this one person was the mother of all people in Africa. The mother of all people. And that's what they did. They counted back. Well, that was 200,000 years ago using that evolutionary type of dating. But when you actually use documented mutations, it's 6,500 years ago. That's not very long. And it's well within the boundaries of this book for what was going on, of creation. I find that interesting. Another thing that's found interesting about mutation rates, and I've got a couple more things to say. When they say, okay, our chimpanzees are our cousins, right? That's science. Okay, these are the same scientists who say there's no Book of Mormon. So, you know, you got to look at that. So us, and a human and a chimpanzee, they say we have a common ancestor. Okay, that 5 million years ago, I think is the latest. 5 million years ago, there was an animal that was the forerunner of both humans and chimpanzees. Okay, that at one point they were together. Well, you know, genetically we should be able to trace that out, right? Well, it's interesting because, you know, it mutates X number of times. The difference between human DNA and a chimpanzee DNA requires a known number of mutations because they're so different. Okay? So to get from point A to point B, we have X number of mutations, I don't know what it is, and they spread them out over 5 million years. Okay? Makes sense, because if they go backwards, 5 million years, they should be the same. But you know, some of those mutations are lethal. You know, I think it's 75% of our DNA is what they call junk DNA. It doesn't really do anything that we know about yet, but it's there. There's only a few spots where they actually know what that part of the DNA does. The rest they call junk DNA because they haven't figured it out. But when those mutations happen in junk DNA, it's no big deal. It doesn't kill you. But every once in a while, those mutations happen in serious DNA that we kind of enjoy having. And it's lethal. That's where we get a lot of our diseases. They're genetic. When you compare the mutation rates, make a long story short, and you're going, yeah, right. The deleterious mutation rate, that when you count back that way, it would take, and this is for you ladies, each female would need to produce 40 offspring for two to survive and maintain the population at its current size. You're going to have 40 kids, but only two of them are going to be genetically able to survive. The rest are going to have fatal genetic mutations to try and go back 5 million years so that chimpanzees and Americans and humans have that common ancestor. Okay? I don't want to say, well, science is bad, because science isn't bad. Science has done a lot of good things, and I kind of enjoy it. But it has its limitations. And actually, we can use DNA to say, you know what? There's no way we could have evolved from the same thing in the time period you're talking about. We were created differently. Our DNA is different. And the mutations, you know, are impossible in the time frame that they're talking about. So, all this DNA evidence, supposed evidence, I want it to be, you know, I want it to be able to say, okay, this is coming over the horizon. If you guys haven't heard about it yet, you probably will someday. It's just like all the other stuff, is that, you know, one of these days when you're talking to somebody and say, yeah, I believe the Book of Mormon, and they say, well, you know, the DNA has proved that it's not true. And you can say, hey, wait a minute. That's not what I heard. It's called an inoculation. I give you just enough information to make you dangerous. Where you can go out there and say, wait a minute. I've heard differently. And if it does nothing else than to get you to do the research and compare the stuff, if you want the headaches, I got the papers. I'm not tossing in the Tylenol. That's up to you. But recognize it. Don't be shocked when somebody says it. It says, oh yeah, I've heard that argument before. And I don't believe it. Because, you know, and you know what? I guarantee you, when this criticism dies down and they say, well, maybe we weren't right. Because science always says, we absolutely know this for a fact until 10 years later and they find out, well, we were wrong. But this we know is an absolute fact. Until 10 years later and they find out they're wrong. So this we know is an absolute fact. So it's going to change. And there's going to be other criticisms come along. And you guys have to make your own decisions. You guys have to be able to say, you know, this Book of Mormon, I've read it. I know what it says and what it doesn't say. I've prayed about it. I've had experiences that have touched my heart. This DNA doesn't refute all the archaeological, linguistic, the chiasmus, all the Hebraisms internal to it. All the other mountains of evidence, the DNA cannot rule out. DNA is not the silver bullet for the Book of Mormon. Matter of fact, it's quite the opposite for creation, or opposite for evolution. It'll be its downfall, and that's a good thing. But understand that this is just another criticism, and it started in 1830, or before 1830, when it was first published, and it won't be the last. Don't look for science to prove the Book of Mormon, but be wary if it says it can disprove it. You know, ask those questions. Well, you know, show me. So pretend you're from Missouri. Prove it. Prove all things and hold fast that which is good, I guess is what it boils down to. Well, I hope that you at least understood. There's a bunch of other stuff I could go through, but I don't want to keep you longer. Like I said, it's an inoculation. I just want to expose you to it so you're not surprised when you hear it. Know that the science behind it is not sound. That the science, that the claims are not based on the scientists, but it's based on people reinterpreting the science that's been done. And that the science is flawed when they're willing to rule out things because they don't fit what their conclusions are. So, I thank you for your time.
About you, but I know more about DNA than I thought I ever wanted to. No, I find it very, very interesting. And I, too, I kind of looked for the day that that would be a proof for the Book of Mormon. And I guess that, you know, like Bob said, it's really a spiritual document, not something that's proved by physical things. We'll close our service this evening with the use of number 407, number 407. You please stand as we sing. Thank you. you bow your heads with me in prayer? Our kind and gracious Father, as we come to the close of this hour, we are indeed thankful for the words we've heard this night. We pray, Father, that you'd help us to understand all things, that we might be good servants before you, that we might be able to defend those things which are so dear to us. Help us, Father, that we may recognize the power of the adversary and his presence always, that he would be battling against those things which are true. And help us, Father, to see thee and to see thee be victorious in all these things and recognize it's not in our own strength. I pray that you'd bless us now as we leave here, that you'd keep us safe, that you'd help us to stand as a good example before those that are around us. Strengthen us until we have opportunity to come again, I pray. And these things we ask in Christ's name. Amen.